Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Se van acercando las vacaciones, y si tienes un bebé en casa, seguro que te preocupa cómo organizar sus comidas durante los viajes, los días de playa o las salidas a la montaña. Una opción cómoda y muy socorrida son los potitos de Nutriben, porque saben cuánto te preocupa dar a tu bebé tarritos nutritivos y con todas las garantías. Los potitos se preparan aquí en España, con los mejores ingredientes, como frutas, verduras, carnes o pescados, y solo emplean aceite de oliva virgen extra. Esos ingredientes tal cual se trituran, cocinan y se envasan al vacío para su correcta conservación. Y ya sabes que igual de importantes son los ingredientes que lleva un alimento como los que no lleva. Los potitos de Nutriben son tarritos que no contienen sal, azúcares añadidos, almidón, colorantes, conservantes, gluten o aceite de palma. Recuerda que los únicos potitos son de Nutriben. Gracias a Nutriben y a su marca Potitos por apoyar los buenos contenidos en este podcast. Hello, I'm Cristina Mitre, journalist and author of the Beauty Mail blog. Welcome to my podcast, where every week I will chat with top experts in cosmetics, nutrition, fitness, and wellness to help you feel good and look better. Esther Perel has proved the intricacies of love and desire in mother couples for almost 30 years as a therapist, writer, trainer, and lecturer. This is a hard one for a Spaniard, eh? Her famous TED Talks have more than 30 million views, and she's the host and producer of the podcast, Where Should We Begin? She has just recently launched in Spain her latest book, The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity, El Dilema de la Pareja, Una Nueva Mirada Acerca del Amor y las Relaciones. Esther, welcome to my podcast.
Thank you. Un placer estar contigo.
Esther, the first question is almost mandatory. Why a book about infidelity?
Because I write about infidelity as a way also of understanding modern relationships and modern marriage for that matter. Because infidelity has been condemned historically and practiced historically, because it is so common in couples that I work with, in families that I see. And when I ask people, have you been affected by the experience of infidelity in your life as the child of a parent who was unfaithful, or a parent who left, or a half sibling you discovered at some point, or a friend who is the confidant of someone who is in the throes of an affair, or the lover who closes the triangle, or the person who was betrayed, about 80% of the people raise their hands. This is not a strange occurrence, and yet it is deeply misunderstood. It is often treated as black and white and victim and perpetrator. And I thought we can do better at this moment where this phenomenon is so prevalent. As a therapist, as a person who writes about relationship, as a podcaster on relationships, I wanted to delve into this very complex territory.
In fact, you say in the book that affairs have a lot to teach us about relationships, what we expect, what we think we want, and what we feel entitled to. Can you give us some examples?
Well, look, today, certainly in the West, people choose their partners. They are no longer introduced to them by their families. They get to live with these partners before they make a commitment to them. They get to choose them among 1,000 people at their fingertips on an app. They get to really do, you know, a careful choice. And when they meet that person, they have a feeling often that they have met their soulmate. Soulmate used to be God. Today, it's the partner. And that means that I have found the person, the one and only, with whom I'm going to expect everything that we want from our committed relationships today, which is not just anymore bare survival. It's not even just basically a friendship and a sense of belonging and connection. It's really to become the best version of myself. Those are the expectations. It's relationships today, intimate relationships today are like an identity project. You're going to help me develop. You're going to help me grow. You're going to help me become the best person I can be. And when infidelity occurs under those expectations, it is a total crash.
So we've got literally the wrong expectation regarding marriage and relationships then.
I don't know if it's the wrong expectations. I would say that our expectations have risen exponentially. We have unprecedented expectations for a partner with whom we want everything of the everyday life and everything having to do with our sense of security and dependence and safety and reliability and family life and a partner and an intellectual interlocutor and a best friend and a passionate lover and a trusted confidant. And we want all of this in one person. I often say we are really asking from one person what once an entire village used to provide. But when we succeed, the good relationships of today, as Eli Finkel says, are often way better than any relationships in history. But the fact is, not everybody can climb Mount Olympus.
Yeah, I see. Does infidelity happen only when there's something missing in that relationship? Do happy people cheat?
Look, we would love to think that infidelity happens only when there is a problem or something missing. Because when I meet the one and only, the point is that I won't be missing anything. If you have found one person for everything, then that person, if they go elsewhere, then it means you were not enough. Then it means there was something missing. Because if you have everything at home, there should be no reason to go elsewhere. It's a whole tautology. And so we really believe in the symptom theory of infidelity. If there is an affair, if there is cheating, it's because there's something wrong or missing. Either there's something missing in you, or there's something missing in me, or there's something missing in our relationship. It never looks at the fact that maybe marriages are by definition incomplete, imperfect creations, and that sometimes, yes, affairs are the expression of long-standing loneliness, of neglect, of relational betrayals, of contempt, of lack of communication, of lack of intimacy. There's so many reasons in the relationship that make people go elsewhere. But there are also a lot of relationships where people are fairly content and they never thought they would do this. It was the last thing they ever thought. They condemned everybody else who does such a thing. And these are the people that really struck me the most, because they kept saying to me, it's not that I was looking for another person or for another partner. It's that I was looking for another self. It's not that I wanted to leave the person that I am with. I wanted to leave the person that I myself have become. And then you start to look at infidelity from an angle of longing and loss and yearning that is very different from the typical cheap shot of just, you know, chronic philanderer, dissatisfied person. There are many, many, many different kinds of infidelities. But the question one always asks is, why do people one day cross a line that they never thought they would cross? At the risk of losing everything they have built, it's a high-risk enterprise. For what? What is it that they are looking for? That's what I was really interested in. I wasn't interested so much in the statistics, but I was interested in the stories behind the statistics.
Mm-hmm. And as a psychotherapist, how do you approach infidelity in your work? Because you say that you've seen so many people, so probably there are like different types of affairs.
I would say that as a therapist, the first thing I do, I meet with people at many, many entry points. I can meet with a couple where I know there is an affair happening, but the partner doesn't know it yet. Or when I think something is happening, but nobody wants to talk about it and nobody wants to ask the question. Or where I am with someone who has decided on their own to leave their affair. and they are in mourning about it, but they have never told it. Or where the children have just discovered the iPhone of the parent. Or where a friend has just come and told them, you know, here is the story about your partner. Or that their parents who have been married for 40 years, the mother just leaves for another woman. Or, I mean, it is so vast. So I think that first is, which is the story here? What stage of the story am I meeting the couple, the person, or the family? And two, I am not a defender of marriage, and I am not a promoter of divorce. I am not the moral police here. I enter situations with curiosity, with a deep desire for understanding, with hoping that people will not create too much damage, long-standing damage that is intergenerational. You know, these stories go a long time. And I try to help people act with dignity and act with accountability.
But if they go to you, it's basically because they want to fix it.
That depends. Yes. I mean, you could say that the others go to the lawyers. So that is true that on some level, if you choose a therapist versus, but fixing it can mean a lot of different things. Fixing it for some people is, I want you to apologize. I want you to own up to it. I want you to tell me the truth. I want you to crawl on the floor. It can have a lot of things. Or fixing it may mean, you know, I want my revenge. Or fixing it can mean, I want to take responsibility for what I did to the degradation of our relationship so that you can... So that it doesn't just become, I blame you. So there's a lot of ways. What is it that people really want? Do they want to just put it under the carpet? Do they say, you know, I don't want to talk about this anymore. Do they want to only talk about this? And there is nothing else that has ever happened in this marriage besides the affair. So I like the word staying together or fixing, but I have no idea what it means until I ask you, for you, Mitra, what is fixing?
Why does sexual betrayal hurt so much?
Look, I think betrayal has always hurt. It's the betrayal hurts because it says you put your interest ahead of mine or ours. I thought we had an agreement. I thought we had an understanding. I thought we had made promises to each other, and you went behind my back. And you basically devalued our entire relationship by elevating something else. But today, the sexual betrayal hurts even more because the meaning of sex has fundamentally changed in a relationship. Sex in traditional marriage, and certainly in Spain, was for procreation. You know, it wasn't for intimacy and connection and self-exploration and transcendence. So, you know, to understand why sexual betrayal hurts. Sexual betrayal hurts in particular when the meaning of sex has completely changed and has become one of the most important ingredients today to how we look at marital happiness. So that's why it hurts differently. It always has, but it hurts differently.
Esther, is it possible to love more than one person at once?
If you ask the people who do, they will tell you yes. I mean, this is a very philosophical question. And what kind of love are we talking about? And is it the same love or is it different love? You know, the question, but in and of itself, of course we can. Of course we can. You know, the underlying question of this is monogamy natural? No, monogamy was never meant to be natural. Monogamy is a social system. It has nothing to do with human nature. It has to do with social structures. And monogamy was forever in history, primarily an imposition on women. Men have practically had a license to cheat. With, you know, men's identity and nature is seen, and men are by nature not monogamous, and women are by nature monogamous. Seriously? Okay, who can make such a statement, you know? Monogamy was an imposition on women primarily for economic reasons and for patrimony. Who are these children belong to? Whose children are these? And who will get the cows when I die? And because we never could prove paternity, women had to have enforced monogamy. And men basically were considered you know, creatures who like variety and who get bored and who by nature are conquistadors and wanderers, and women like domesticity. And this is predicated on an entire long-standing cultural and religious history that has very little to do with nature. Nature, yes, you can love many people.
You say something in the book that it really got me. You say, once divorce carried all the stigma, now choosing to stay when you can leave is the new shame. And you put the example of Hillary Clinton, when people was asking, where is her self-respect? Mm-hmm. Because she stayed. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
I think this is one of the really important discoveries of this 10-year research on infidelity. And by the way, in the Latin continent, this is even worse for men. If it's bad for women to stay and to have to hide staying with somebody who has cheated on them, it is even worse for men. Because to the woman, they may say she's weak. To the man, they will say he's not a real man. You know, masculinity constantly has to prove itself. So why is that? It used to be that when people divorced, this was the stigma. And infidelity, people lived with it. Women lived with it. Why? Because they had economic dependence, because their children belonged to the father, because they had very little rights. And therefore, you protected the family, and the stability of the family was certainly more important than your individual happiness. Marriage is no longer just about the family. Marriage is very much about the individual happiness. Women have, in many parts of the world, certainly not enough, acquired some ability to be economically independent, to be able to support themselves if they leave. And so today, the statement is, now that you can go, Miss Hillary or Miss whoever, how is it that you are willing to stay with this? For us, all these centuries that women couldn't have a choice and couldn't leave, you who can, how dare you stay? With this notion, you know, that by definition, you know, if the person cheated on you, everything has been destroyed, which sometimes is true, but sometimes is not. The same person who just cheated on you is still the one who goes visit your mother every week at the nursing home, and still the one who is making sure that your alcoholic brother can pay his rent, and still the one who is helping you with your new project because he believes in everything you do. You know, this is so simple to just say, and I'm not talking about just any kind of sex outside relationships. I'm talking about affairs in particular. This idea that the person who has had an affair doesn't love you anymore, or doesn't care about you, or is worthless, or that your entire marriage or relationship is worthless because of it, or that you don't care about them, or that you don't somewhere know that you have been rejecting them for the last 12 years sexually every time they come near you, and that you know on some level, you know, it's all of that that goes in there. So that's part of the issue here of why people will stay. They will stay because they still love the person. They will stay because somewhere they know that they contributed in some way to the degradation of the relationship. They didn't create the affair, that's for sure. Two people are responsible for the relationship. One person chooses to have an affair. That's a given. They will stay because they like the life they have and they don't want to lose their entire life. They will stay because they like the economic care that they get. They will stay because they have young children. They will stay because they have a special need child. They will stay because their Alzheimer's mother is living with them. There's a lot of reasons to stay in a relationship that doesn't just have to do with my personal happiness. And it's easy to just say to the women, you know, none of this matters. Your self-respect, you know, and for the men, worse. The men will live in total shame about this. They won't admit it.
But it seems that when there's an infidelity, it's like if divorce is the only option. But I wonder if it's the right option.
In some situations, there is very little left. And so people feel, now that we can divorce, now that we can start all over, why not? You know, I will not live in a situation that is so degrading, that is so disrespectful, that is so humiliating, all of that. In other situations, people have a good marriage. This is the same question you asked me above. You know, can this happen in good relationships? And people say, I'm going to fight for you. I'm not just letting you go. I care about what we've built. And you know, we see so many relationships where people worked through the crisis of an affair. You know, there's many other crises that people, that couples go through, and nobody just says automatically, divorce, leave, leave, throw the dog on the curb, get out. It's this, in, you know, take a minute, examine what happened here. You may have to go. This may be beyond repair. But in many, many other situations, we see people who, I'm, you know, this project started because I went back to couples who had chosen to stay together 5, 10, 15 years later and asked them, what happened to your relationships? You could have left. All the others left. I know what happened to them. What happened to you? And it's really interesting to see the kinds of outcomes that people have when they choose to stay together. So divorce is one option. It is not the only option, and it is not always the option.
Yeah. In fact, you say in the book that people that choose to stay together despite the affair, there are three kind of people, the sufferers, the builders, and the explorers. Yes. Could you please describe them a little bit?
Because in my tracking, you know, dozens and dozens of couples that I had seen over the years, I saw that, you know, there is a group of people who stay together because they have a kind of codependence. They need each other. They can't be with each other, but they can't be without each other. Can't be with, can't be without. And they often live with the affair at the epicenter of the relationship. Everything that happens, they bring back the affair. One person comes 5 minutes late. The other one says, I waited all those years and you still can't. You know, they just, you can never, never forgive. You can never let go. You can never transcend. This thing is the organizing principle and they are locked in a marital cell. That's what I, that's the first group. The second group, the builders, I saw are people who really believe in the stability of the family and in the continuity of the marriage. And they are, they say, divorce is not an option for me. I came from divorce. I know what it does to me to, as a child. I won't do this to my children. We are good partners. We have a business together. We have a little shop together. Whatever it is, I am, you know, I want this. I need this life. I need this family. I need this relationship. It's not always a family. I need us and the dog. It doesn't have to have only children. And those people often will put the subject under the mat and that's it. We don't talk about it. We don't see it as what can it teach us? What can we learn from it? What does it tell us about the relationship we really want to be in? It just is, this was a terrible crisis. We weathered it. We overcame it. That's it. The explorers are the people who say, what is this telling us? And can we use this to actually become a different couple? Maybe the couple we want to be today after 26 years that we were together under one model. What does the affair teach us and about our relationship and about what we want for our future relationship? I always say, today in the West, most of us will have two or three adult relationships or marriages. Some of us are going to do it with the same person. This affair is the end of your first marriage. For most people, some will go find a second marriage with somebody else. And some will be able to create a second marriage or a second relationship with each other.
At the beginning, you were saying that some people cheat because it's not about the sex, it's about themselves. They want to be someone different. Mm-hmm. But we always think that it's about the sex. And you say that there are three things that are the constitutive elements of an infidelity: secrecy, sexual alchemy. And I really like what you say, that Sheryl Strayed says that it can be dry dating. Mm-hmm. I really like that. And emotional involvement. So those are the three keys always.
Yes, and they come in different quantities. You know, the organizing structure of an affair is the secret, basically. Otherwise, you're in a consensually non-monogamous relationship. The secrecy is what organizes it. But the secrecy is what gives some people a sense of freedom. The secrecy is what gives some people a sense of autonomy. The secrecy is what does to the other person lying, deception, duplicity, betrayal, violation of trust. So it has completely different meanings sometimes on both sides. Alchemy, to me, is the most important piece of this thing, because people can have, especially today, especially under COVID, nobody's leaving the house, you know. They're not literally going to meet anybody, but they may have a whole relationship with somebody, because the power of the imagination is what is creating this affair. An affair is a story. It's an imaginative story, basically, you know. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end very often. And it tells the story of what? And so that's what we want to ask. When the most important word that people all over the world, when I talk to people who are in affairs or have had affairs, what they felt is alive. And the aliveness doesn't come because they had good sex. Sometimes they never even touched each other. But they felt alive because somebody paid attention to them, because they felt less lonely, because they didn't feel ignored, because someone laughed at their jokes, because somebody found them attractive and saw them and they didn't feel invisible, because somebody desired them, because they desired for the first time again after not feeling any desire in their body for years, not knowing if they could ever feel like this again. And suddenly, wow, I still have it in me. I can still feel a woman. I can still feel a man. I can still feel a sexual being. And all of those things have very little to do with doing sex. They have to do with desire, with vibrancy, vitality, aliveness, connection, freedom, possibility. The world that I'm not living, the life that I'm not living. And that's not to say affairs are good and affairs are great. This is just to explain what people really experience and describe. I'm the last one to be an apologist of infidelity here, but I think it's important to understand that for some people, the sex is a central part of it. But for some people, the sexuality, the erotic nature of this is actually what this is about.
You were talking about desire, and I wonder if the desire to feel desired is actually cheating or not.
Depends who you ask. You see, the thing today is that the definition of infidelity has been completely redefined. For most of history, an infidelity meant that 9 months later there was a baby and the color of the hair of that baby did not resemble yours. So everybody knew exactly where cheating took place. And for most of history, religious institutions basically controlled and defined what is infidelity. Today, is infidelity watching porn? Is infidelity chatting? Is it about reconnecting with an ex on Facebook? Is it about, you know, fantasizing being desired by others? Is it about masturbating while there is somebody next to you in bed? Where is the line? Is today something that every couple has to define in ways that it never had to define, because it was defined by the authorities. And that definition, unfortunately, most couples don't do. They only talk about it when there is a crisis. You know, the majority of straight couples, when they negotiate monogamy, it's one sentence. I catch you and you're dead.
What can we learn from those experiences without necessarily having to go through an affair?
If people were to put in their relationships 1% of the imaginative energy that they bring to their affairs, relationships would be doing much better. I mean, it's not that people don't know what to do. They do it often when they do have the affairs. So it's about how do we cultivate aliveness, energy, curiosity, playfulness in our relationships? How do we keep those relationships vibrant? Because that is what people often go to look for or to experience or suddenly stumble upon when they do have an affair.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
¿Sabías que los bebés son capaces de autorregularse y comer lo que necesitan? Hasta el primer año, la leche ha de ser su alimento principal, bien sea lactancia materna o artificial, y poco a poco podrán ir probando diferentes texturas y alimentos. Ahora, con buena temperatura, a todos nos gusta salir más de casa, y en verano pasamos mucho tiempo fuera, en la playa, la montaña o recorriendo el mundo. Si tienes un bebé que ya ha empezado con la alimentación complementaria, para esos momentos puedes contar con los diferentes tarritos que ofrece Potitos. Hay recetas para bebés desde 4 y 6 meses y solo llevan ingredientes como frutas, verduras, carnes o pescados que se trituran y se envasan tal cual. Los Potitos de Nutribel son tarritos seguros, fáciles de conservar y transportar, ya que no necesitan refrigeración, tan solo mantenerse en un lugar fresco. Se calientan en microondas o al baño María, sin conservantes ni azúcares añadidos. Gracias a Nutriben y a su marca Potitos por ser nuestro mecenas del mes.
You say in the book that not only can an affair destroy a marriage, it has the power to unravel an entire social fabric. So I wonder that sometimes this is not only about myself, it's about the whole family, it's about us. And that's probably why it hurts so much.
Definitely. Affairs are systemic. Affairs are social. You know, they create a ripple effect in a whole system. So it's me, it's you, it's the third. That's the first triangle, because there is a third. That person is never mentioned generally. Then there is possibly children. Then there is your parents, my parents, your family, your net. Then there is our friends, those who knew, those who didn't know, those who are shocked, those who are taking sides, those who've done it themselves, those who are saying, you know, how dare you do something like this? So, and then there is the secrets. Then there is the secrets of the people, you know, that like I just this week met a person, you know, who at 20-something goes to look for his birth certificate and figures out that the age of the father entering in his life is not 0 but 3, you know, and then goes to the mother and says, what is that, please? So the secrets travel, you know, through generations. And we have two kinds of memories, right? We have an explicit memory where we know what happened and we tell the story. And then we have the implicit memory. Like this guy, he always felt there was something. There was something. But he couldn't figure out what. Nobody ever told him. But he just kept saying, this guy, how can you be my dad? How can you be my dad? You know, that kind of thing. Implicit memory. So this is, it travels far in circles in terms of the social circle, and it travels deep in time in terms of the transmission, in terms of generations.
Yeah. Esther, are some affairs worse than others?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But the interesting thing is that the reaction of the person who is betrayed is not always commensurate with the severity of the affair. Some people may react with utter despair to a one-night stand, and other people may react with much more composure to a 6-year affair. So there's one thing is to say some affairs are worse than others, but on the part of the person who is on the receiving end of this, the reaction is not always matching the severity of the affair itself. It comes from many other sources, our reaction. You know, if we've been betrayed before, if we were abandoned before, if there was infidelity in our family, we come with a history towards this subject. But some affairs, yes, I think that some affairs are worse by what? By the level of contempt, disregard, carelessness, humiliation that some people can have towards their partner. And in that sense, I would say a relationship that involves narcissism often is a more careless relationship to begin with, in which cheating is just one way, one more way that the person can't think about the well-being of their partner.
How do we recover from an experience like that? Is it possible to recover?
hard. I've seen people who recovered from finding out that their partner had a 20-year parallel life with another child that was born pretty much at the same time as their own daughter. You know, I've seen every variation of it. I think that the shame that people experience as well, you know, that it's very complicated to find out what will help somebody say, I still want to be with you. Because otherwise I have to think that the 22 years I lived with you were a lie. And they were not, because I actually know that what we lived was true as well. It just was that there was a whole other truth going on in the sidelines. In other situations, people say, get me out of here as fast as possible. And I never look back. They just feel like filled with rage and filled with deception and filled with dirty, like a rape of their life, a rape of their reality, a full violation of what they thought their world was. So it goes from this extreme to that extreme.
And does revenge heal that pain or not?
No. Revenge keeps you glued to the other person, basically. You know, I want you to feel what I felt and worse. And I'm going to make you, I'm going to step on you until there is nothing left from you. Because if you die, then at least I can live, you know. But of course, I won't live. I will be thinking about your death every day. You know, hatred is a terrible glue. There is no greater revenge than to free yourself from the clutches of someone who is hurting you. That is the real revenge in a way.
Esther, if we know that the partner of our friend has been unfaithful, should we tell?
That is a very cultural question. That is a cultural, when that question is asked for me in Argentina, they say no, because it's not sure that they want to know. Because once you know, you have to act on the consequences of knowing. In America, yes, you should know your rights. You know, so the United States is, of course, you should know. You should know because you don't get to decide and your partner is making a unilateral decision, which, of course, is what an affair does. So I think there is a very cultural element to this. And I would ask you, you know, in your circle, if you ask this, would you get diverse answers?
Yes, yes. Definitely. I've got friends that they want to know and others that they don't want to know.
And if you ask the same question to the mothers?
To the mothers. I don't know.
So go back in time, ask the mothers, and then ask the abuelitas.
Yeah.
And find out, what they say. I think that as women became more emancipated, they want to know.
They want to know.
As women are in, I know that it doesn't make a difference because they're going to stay no matter what. What point, what good was it in knowing? As long as he doesn't humiliate her when he goes out on the street.
That's so Mad Men, isn't it? I've been watching Mad Men now during this pandemic, and it's so Mad Men. In case you've been unfaithful, what you should confess, how much, and how to do it?
It's a beautiful question. It depends if I found out or if you told me. Or if someone else came to tell me. How you find out is so important in how you're going to experience the infidelity. I found out because the other person sent me pictures, or because the partner of the lover of my partner sent me pictures, or sent me an email with a whole, you know, because I thought you would want to know without asking me. So how you find out has everything to do with what you want to know and how. The next thing is, I think it's very important that people distinguish between the details, the facts of an affair versus the meaning. An affair is an affair. You know, it doesn't look 10 different ways. It means there is a lot of intensity. There can be a lot of passion. There can be all kinds of things people say because they are in the glow, you know, but that doesn't mean that you want to go home and tell your partner, I have loved this man like I have never loved a man in my life. Let's stay married. Seriously? On what basis do you can, you know, can you, who wants to know that? Who can continue to live with you and know that? So when you tell, tell with bienveillance, as we say in French, you know, tell with care and understand what it will be like for the other person to live with that knowledge. Sometimes I say to a person who asks that question, did you love her? Did you love him? And I say, do you want to know the answer to your question? Or do you want your partner to know that you have the question? I want you to know that I'm thinking about it, but I don't know that I want to know.
You say something in the book that really made me think, Esther. You said that perhaps it should not be surprising at all that in a world where men are receiving such conflicting messages about who they are and who they should be, so many of them prefer porn and pay sex. What are we doing wrong?
Look, I don't think we are doing wrong. I think that we are aiming toward relationships that involve more friendship, that involve more equality, that involve more emancipation of the women and the children, that don't take violence as accepted. I actually think that we are in a direction in the West toward relationships that are much better. I don't think we are doing anything wrong at all. At the same time, I understand sometimes that men who feel that to be a partner today is very emotionally demanding on them. Now that she doesn't need him for the money necessarily, and she doesn't even need him for his sperm necessarily, and she doesn't, you know, he is really there to be an emotional partner. And that is something that is very new in the history of manhood. That has not been the role of men, period. They were protectors, they were providers at best. They were the honor of the family, etc., etc. And so what you hear is that men often end up looking for certain versions in their sexual life where they don't have to be emotional caretakers, where they can kind of be without any of that responsibility and allow their more animalistic, lustful side to come out without having to worry that they're hurting anybody. That's what you, I think, is this case that I was describing in the book, where, you know, you wonder, why is this man who loves his wife, who enjoys to be with her, you know, why does he prefer to spend 3 hours a day or 1 hour a day on his screen rather than be with her? You know, what is it that he gets in, you know, when you pay, what is it that you pay for? You don't pay for sex. You pay for someone to not humiliate you. You pay for someone not to have a headache when you initiate. You pay for someone who tells you you are wonderful. And you pay for someone who tells you, I feel wonderful. That's what you pay for. You know, you pay for a psychological good. You know, you pay for someone who thinks that you are still attractive, even though, you know, you're not necessarily think yourself that you are. And you pay not to be rejected. You pay not to feel inadequate. And you pay not to wonder if she's enjoying herself, because she will scream no matter what to pretend. That's what you pay for. That's what men also, I think, often get in porn. It's the same concept. What do you get in porn? You'd get a person who wants it. She's not saying to Ned, you know, I'm not in the mood tonight. She wants it. She doesn't reject you. She doesn't make you feel dirty. She doesn't make you feel greedy or needy. And she affirms you. Basically, in some very interesting ways, the sexual pursuit actually is helping men with their emotional needs. Porn is not nearly only as sexual as we think it is.
So that's a different perspective.
Yes, because we all know the sexual definition of porn. But really, what are the three most important sexual vulnerabilities that men grapple with? The fear of rejection, the fear of inadequacy, and the complete ignorance to know if she's faking it or not. This is the place where she can lie her entire life. And for these three things, often you will find that they don't describe it like that when men talk about going to watch porn. They just talk about, I get turned on, I jerk off, I do, you know. But when you delve a little deeper, especially when they are in relationships, that's when you really begin to say, what is the emotional need that is being met in the sexual space of porn, of sex clubs, of strip clubs, you know, of paid sex of all versions. Strip clubs, you don't pay for the sex necessarily. You play for the environment. And what do regulars mostly want when they go? I talk about regulars, not talking about bachelor parties. They want someone to talk to. That's the strange thing. This is some of the most incredible research done by women who were researching their regulars. And you would think the woman wants to talk. No, he wants to talk too. But he wants to talk in a place where he feels very manly.
So the problem, as always, is that we don't talk about emotions, or we haven't been told how to talk about our emotions.
That's correct. Or I would put it differently. I would say that the language that men use to talk about their emotions, the sanctioned language that men are allowed to use, is sex. Through sex, men can talk about closeness, vulnerability, the wish to surrender, the wish to be taken care of, the wish to take care of somebody else, softness, tenderness, all those feelings that are not allowed in the making of manhood are allowed when they are eroticized, sexualized. So the sanctioned language for men to talk is sex, and the sanctioned language for women to talk about sex is feelings. Every gender has been given a license. What is the proper language that they can talk about their deepest needs in?
Yeah, that's something to think. Esther, I would like to talk about divorce mm-hmm. because in the book, you share the story of Clive and Jade, and you talk about the importance of rituals to facilitate transitions. And there's an idea that I really love. You say that divorce is not the end of a family. It's just a reorganization. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the goodbye letters, because I think it's such a great tip to share with the listeners.
And the goodbye letters, especially when people have been deeply, deeply hurt. I just now did a session, you know, where I worked on goodbye letters in a couple where she left to be with another partner after 42 years. So begin with that, right? Marriages never lasted 42 years. Throughout history. So they ended, you know. The idea that you could have more than one was, you know, unimaginable. Monogamy was one person for life. Today, monogamy is one person at a time. It's a very different definition of monogamy. And when people say it was a failed marriage after 42 years, I think it's a terrible disservice. They have 3 children. They have 7 grandchildren. They have built homes. They have buried parents. They have dealt with illness. They have been for each other in multiple ways that marriage was about. The fact that they felt lonely at times, the fact that one person fell in love with someone else, all of that is there, but that is not the whole story of the marriage. So I start by saying, I want you to say goodbye to your relationship and to each other. And I want you to do it in 4 parts. What I take with me from our relationship. What I hope you take with you from me. What I wished I had done differently, for which I take responsibility. And what I wished you had done differently. And that's kind of the frame of this. So that people are not just going into revisionist history. You know, this was a waste of my time. What did I do here? 4 decades, you know? It's true if it's 15 years too. But the idea is what you take with you. And if you are able to say this ended, but there were some good things that I carry inside of me, you have a much better chance for the next round. If you leave bitter, angry and resentful nonstop, it is not a good thing for your next relationship. And it's certainly not a good thing for whoever children you may have had in this marriage. So I help people hold on to good and to separate it and sort out what was good, what was less good, what was bad, and what was terrible. And I help them also realize that it wasn't just the other person that was terrible, that they have some responsibility as well. Because if it's just what the other person did to you, you know, your partner may have cheated on you. And that really is a terrible thing to do. But we also need to look at, did these people have other relational betrayals in their marriage? Did somebody stop talking to the other person? Stop paying attention to the other person? Act with neglect and contempt toward the other person? was violent to the other person, was abusive, was drinking, was having a relationship with their work, with their bottle, with their mother, whatever it is. You know, there are lots of ways people have abandoned each other and not kept their promises. And a full assessment of a relationship is what I do when I do a goodbye letter. And they read it out loud in the session. They read the letter that the other person wrote. So they read it as the reader. So the writer gets to hear themselves out loud, and the reader gets to read it out loud in the presence of the writer. Stuff that they haven't done in years. These two people were sobbing. It was just, it breaks your heart. They were going back and forth between hurt and anger, hurt and anger. But it was so painful, you know. And he says, I can't bear watching you. I miss you. I miss you. And how did you do this to me? And it goes back and forth between you left me, I love you, I hate you. It's all the feelings together, you know. It's this, but this is the complexity of human relationships, and it deserves its respect.
Esther, I always ask my guests to put an end to the interview with one last tip. Do you dare to do it in Spanish?
La calidad de nuestras relaciones determina la calidad de nuestra vida. Cada vez uno tiene que pedirse a sí mismo o preguntarse a sí mismo, ¿estoy haciendo lo mejor que puedo en mi relación? La pregunta no es solamente si estoy con la buena persona, pero también si yo soy la buena persona. ¿Cómo me comporto yo? Si doy lo mejor que tengo a mi trabajo y que llevo el resto a casa, no puedo mantener una relación en vivo. Y la última frase sería de decir, hay una diferencia entre ser una pareja, un casal, que no está muerta, y otra que está en vivo. To be alive and not to be dead. Ahí es la diferencia en lo que queremos todos en nuestras vidas amorosas.
Such a good tip and such a good wrap up. Esther, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
And hopefully we will see you in Spain soon. Don't forget that all the notes for this episode are in my blog, thebeautymail.es. Also, if you don't want to miss an interview, subscribe to the Cristina Mitre podcast on your regular podcast app. And one last favor. If you listen to me on Apple Podcasts, give me a few stars and leave a review. That way, you will help this podcast to continue growing. Thank you very much. You will be hearing from me again next Sunday.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.